There is an endless sea of podcasts about entrepreneurship. Talking about it, but not living it. We live it every day. This is Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel, talking about real estate investing, but also encompassing general subjects in regards to owning small to medium-sized businesses, and of course, all the struggles that business owners must overcome to be successful. This is Inside the Wolf's Den, and this is Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel.
Welcome back to Inside the Wolf's Den with your hosts, Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel. Today we have a special guest, one of our personal friends, Tim Brotz. Tim is a founder and CEO of Legacy Wealth Holdings. He focuses on vision casting, marketing, and supporting his 8 team players. He has built his company on integrity, fairness, and transparency. Tim has dedicated his professional life to studying wealth building and professional finance. Working in real estate, Tim has learned how to create a passive income and allows him to live the lifestyle of his choice. His goal is to educate and empower others to become financially free through entrepreneurship and real estate investing. Also known as the multifamily guy, has a huge, large portfolio of multifamilies, and also a published author of has a series of children's books, which you can see here, which my children absolutely love. So we'll learn a little bit more about that as well. So, Tim, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm excited to have our listeners get to know you a little better.
Now, I'm excited to be here. And thank you guys for not only having me, but I have a ton of respect for you guys. Appreciate all the value and all the content you're always putting out there. And just appreciate our friendship. So thanks again for having me.
Absolutely. Why don't you start off by giving us a little background on yourself?
Yeah. So I'm a Midwest kid. I was born in the suburbs of Cleveland and grew up there and just kind of going through school and going through college. I was going through college 03 to 07 and everybody's making money in real estate. So it's kind of what motivated me as a 20-year-old kid. Got involved in the construction trades a little bit, had a painting business when I was in college and worked for a large home builder. And then when I graduated from college in 2007, ended up moving out to New York City and living with my brother out there. And he's like, come and live with me and do real estate. And so I thought you got involved in real estate by becoming a real estate agent. And so I got my real estate license and parked it with a commercial brokerage for some reason. I don't even know why. And I negotiated leases for businesses and landlords with retail or office space. And during that whole process, it's, learning a lot. This is in 2007. Mm-hmm. And in early 2008, closed my first lease transaction. And so it took a long time to close it, but it was a big deal. Like I was doing the math on it. It's only 400 square feet, but I had a restaurant come in and rent 400 square feet on a 12-year lease term for $10,000 a month with 4% annual increases. And I remember just doing the math on that as a money hungry 22-year-old kid. And oh my gosh, this landlord's going to make almost $2 million over the next 12 years for doing something once. And that's when residual income really set in with me. And I realized I wanted to become a real estate investor, not just a broker, mm-hmm. And so I ended up moving down to Charleston, South Carolina, just for quality of life purposes. I wanted to be somewhere a little bit warmer. And when I was in Charleston, I went through that whole analysis paralysis phase that I think a lot of people go through, mm-hmm. where just kind of reading and you're buying all the courses and studying and thinking, I got to learn everything before I do anything. And I don't think that's the right way to do it. Obviously, a lot of us go through that phase, but you really learn from actually doing and from just getting in the trenches. And I always compare it to swimming, right? Like you can read about swimming in a book, but you can't really understand how to swim until you get in the water.
Right.
And that's what you have to do in real estate too. You got to just go out and buy a deal. And that's what I ended up doing. I ended up, now this is right after 08, the whole crash happened. Mm-hmm. And that's when I'm going through my analysis paralysis. Now everybody's like, run from real estate. And everybody lost money in real estate. And I remember seeing that and thinking, I just showed up, but I couldn't get any money. Nobody's going to give me money because it's the worst economy ever. Mm-hmm. I've never done a deal before. And I'm 22 years old at the time. And so, or 23 maybe at the time. And, but this one this one guy had money. His name was MasterCard and gave me.
Wow.
I called up MasterCard and I was like, hey, I need you to increase my limit. And they increased my credit limit from whatever it was, a few thousand dollars up to $15,000. And I found the cheapest house in the entire MLS. And I bought it in April of 2009 and just fixed it all up. I did all the work to it and ended up flipping it within about, I don't know, 3-4 months. And made like $13,000 or $14,000 on it. And I was like, everybody's running from real estate. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm making money in this stuff. Like, I got this figured out. So, you know, built up a little bit of a portfolio on the residential side, got involved in some other businesses where I lost a lot of money and kind of came back to real estate that saved me and moved back to Cleveland in 2012. And that's when I started finding some apartment buildings. And I bought my first apartment building right around Christmas of 2012. And I just love the scale in it. And so focused on that over the next several years. And again, had some good partnerships, bad partnerships, got into property management, had the turnkey business, had a lot of different things going on. But really apartments was always my long-term goal. And now that's all that I do. So I focus exclusively on apartments. I have 4,288 units as we're sitting here today. 90% of those is apartments. The other 10% is kind of a mix of storage. I have some office buildings and some vacation rentals, but I'm really an apartment guy. I really like apartments a lot.
Yeah. You're the only other person that, so Joni and I bought our first house with a credit card. So, and
did you?
Yeah.
And I don't think you've told us that story. Yeah. What an awesome story. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So everybody looks at us like we're totally crazy and probably were at the time, but I mean, I think we were 19. Mm-hmm. And we took, yeah, just took.
Where else do you get money from, right? You're like, hey, you're giving out money.
Yeah, so
called them up. The lady's like, what do you need? I was like, I'm about to make a big purchase. I need you to increase my limit. Yeah. And she's like, yeah, well, how much? I was like, 100,000. And she's like, absolutely not. No. You've been a great customer for 15 months since you got out of college, but we're not giving you $100,000 unsecured. I was like, well, what can you give me? She's like, 15 grand. I was like, done.
Done. How'd you get over because you were in the paralysis analysis phase. How did you get over that fear to do that first one? Because I think there's a ton of people that live there.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it just kind of weighed on me. And I was like, all right. So I learned this and I learned that. And then eventually the market just crashed and all these bank owned properties started popping up on the MLS and they were really cheap. I was like, man, I could probably go out and like buy these things super cheap. I just need to go find the money. And I was doing a little bit of like, there was a lot of short sale stuff going on back then. Mm-hmm. And there were people like literally giving their houses away mm-hmm. for like, hey, I'm gonna get foreclosed on. Let me just sign over the deed to
right.
you. And I was kind of like working side by side, just kind of doing like property management type stuff is make a couple extra bucks for this guy that was doing that, but she just wasn't doing it the right way. And I didn't know any better, but this guy would tell people he'd go and negotiate a short sale on their house, have them sign over the deed. And then he'd just rent the house out and he'd try to negotiate either a loan modification or a short sale, but they wouldn't try that hard. And then he would just collect rents and not pay the banks anything. And then the banks would eventually foreclose. And so I realized he was a bad guy and I got out of that immediately. And I realized I just need to go out and like do my own thing. And so that's when I was like, where am I going to get the money? How am I going to do this? And I just kind of took the leap. I don't know. I came to a point where I was like, I'm banging my head against the wall. I'm almost going to run out of money if I don't pull the trigger and make money pretty soon. And it's going to be either go get a job or find a house to flip. And I ended up flipping a house.
I mean, it's just about taking action, but I mean, you're going to make mistakes, mm-hmm. which I'm sure you've made a lot of mistakes along the way.
Yeah,
for sure. So many.
I always tell people I've just made a lot more mistakes than you have.
You know? Here's the thing. People probably wouldn't get involved in real estate if they knew all the struggles and all the heartache that comes with it. You know, like I could tell you stories about walking into houses and I open up the door and roaches fall on my head from the door jam. Walking out of houses with fleas all up my pants, just like leaving my jeans there, driving home in my underwear, you know, fumigating my car after going in these houses.
I took our kids one time to a house and didn't realize it was like so flea infested. So like, we just bought it. I'm like, well, let's walk it and see what we need to happen on it. And I took them and they got so, I was wearing jeans. They were wearing shorts. They had bites all up their leg. That's the last house they'll ever go to.
And they're scarred today. They're like, hey, mom, look at all these scars from the fleas I had.
But, yeah.
It's money.
Dealing with tenants, contractors, like everybody's, you know, taking advantage of you. It's private money lenders backing out at the last minute. Just, you know, you've been through all of it. But I think one of the things is like, most of your days are going to be more average and maybe even below average, but like those good ones are so good that it makes all the other ones worthwhile.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. So tell us, because a lot of our listeners are either doing single family real estate or just thinking about getting into it. But you're an expert in multifamily and you can add a lot of value because it's something that Joni and I don't do a lot of. So tell me like the transition from single family to multifamily. Tell us, is it, do you have to get into single family to get into multifamily? You know, do you have to make that transition like we have done or you've done? And then maybe like the pros and cons of multifamily just to.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. And it's probably one that's at the forefront of most people's minds is, you know, like I got involved in real estate and I was brokering commercial and I was already a little bit familiar, but it still seemed so complex to me. Mm-hmm. And it seems so out of reach for me. The words that they use were different and the language and the way that they underwrote seemed so sophisticated. And to me, you know, I don't know, I didn't go to some Ivy League school with a finance or real estate degree. And I don't come from, you know, a family that owned a bunch of commercial real estate. And I never, you know, had these fancy initials behind my name because I took a bunch of commercial real estate courses or anything like that. So for me, I just kind of gradually went from single family. And when I came across my first apartment building in December of 2012, that building, I used the same strategy that I used to buy houses. And, you know, it's the same formula. I got to be all in purchase price and renovation cost for 65% of that after repair value, right? Like that's like a standard formula a lot of people use. And I said, if it works for single family, why couldn't I use it for apartments? Mm-hmm. And that's how I bought that first apartment building. And I've never taken a class actually on apartments. Well. I've never read a book on apartments. Everything I've learned is from the School of Hard Knocks. And I think the reason I've had a lot of success and it's, I've raised a lot of money. I have over $50 million of mom and pop money. I've never raised institutional equity at all. Just, you know, $50 million of mom and pop money, people with a few hundred thousand dollars in my deals. And the reason I think I've had a lot of success is because I just keep it simple, right? I don't overly complicate it. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of break it down to a third grade level. Remember, I'm a blue collar kid from Cleveland, so I can't think at that high of a level. Got to be pretty basic and pretty simple for me. And because I can take those complex things and make it simple for other people, I'm able to source really, really good deals and I'm able to raise a lot of capital. We've gotten really, really good at raising money. So like that's been one of those things. Sean, to go back to your question of, do you have to start in single family? I don't think you have to. The question is, or the answer is, you just have to start, right? Whether that's single family or a duplex or a quadplex or an 8-unit, I will say you're probably not going to fall into a 100-unit apartment building as your first deal, just because those get snatched up by people that are out there and in the mix and doing big deals and have big balance sheets and have the experience and the relationships. But do you have to start with a single family? No, you can start with a duplex. You start with a 8-plex. And then kind of organically grow that way. That's what I did. I started, you know, with single families, got into small multi, a triplex, a duplex, an 8-unit, another 8-unit, 14-unit, 23, 31, 82, and just kept on growing organically. But I didn't know that there was ways you could fast track it too. And I think what's important is to really build the momentum. The momentum is the most important thing that I think anybody can get going. And I know a lot of the gurus out there only teach people to only go after 80 unit buildings and bigger, 100 unit buildings and bigger. If you're new, you're not going to get those. You know, those are going to get grabbed by people like me. You're going up to bat against somebody with a 4,000 unit balance sheet. Mm-hmm. They're just not going to give a newbie the amount of respect that they deserve in that type of situation. So you got to organically just build the balance sheet, get things going. We were talking beforehand about me selling a portion of my portfolio. And you're like, why? Well, it's because those properties were the smaller buildings that I bought earlier on that got me up to a few hundred units, and then I could go and play with the big boys and big girls and negotiate against them for these bigger properties. Mm-hmm. Now that I have a big balance sheet, I can sell those smaller properties. They serve their purpose, and now I can just focus on the big stuff. So I think it's important, really important, for people to get going, start taking down deals. If you can't raise money on a $200,000 deal, how are you going to raise money on a $2 million or a $20 million deal? Mm-hmm. And so I really think it's important that you just kind of, you know, grow organically and realize, though, that if you do come across a 100-unit building, don't be discouraged and don't just walk away from it. There's people like me and other investors in your own hometown who would then joint venture with you or partner with you in some capacity, mm-hmm. And sponsor the loan. I mean, sign on the loan, co-sign on the loan, mm-hmm. or raise the money and bring the down payment capital and mentor you and coach you through that. So you can actually fast track a little bit. And that's one of the things that I do with a lot of people that I consult with, is they go out and do deals, and they're out doing their own 30 unit deals and 20 unit deals. And then when they come across 150 units or 550 units, like the one I was telling you guys about, mm-hmm. in Houston that we're taking a look at, they needed somebody with a little bit more experience. Right. And so it's a, you know, it's a win-win. They are able to get into better deals, with getting deals that they couldn't have gotten into, and I can get into deals that maybe I couldn't have gotten into, and rising tide floats all boats.
That's awesome. No, there was several huge value drops in there. I don't know if I want to repeat some of them. You don't start with single family. You can start with small multi-family, work your way up, you know, get experience, grow your balance sheet like you did, until you can trade up. But the other one that I really liked was you, and it's key because it's something, Joni and I started small too and worked our way and traded up. I think there's too many people that think they can just come out and gonna hit a home run, right. You know, off the first, and it usually doesn't mm-hmm. happen that way. Mm-hmm. But you have said something else.
Ball games are won. You guys are from Houston. You guys know this. Ball games are won with base hits, right?
Absolutely.
Base hit after base hit. It's not won with home runs and grand slams. It's steady base hits.
I mean,
more
base
hits. Exactly right.
And something
you're
not
going to be able to hit a home mm-hmm. run unless you're getting base hits.
Correct. And something that kept us in business in 7 and 8, because we've been at this for 20 years, was Joni and I were hitting those single, you know, bats, you know, and single base hits. And while people were trying to go to Nevada and mm-hmm. Florida and all these places trying to make all this killing, all of them got destroyed in the last recession. So, but something else that was key was you said that you're true to who you are. You use your experience or the way like you said, you're a blue collar person mm-hmm. from Ohio. You use that to your advantage to relate to other people, and I think people miss that. They try to be somebody they're not, and you use it to your advantage to relate, to build rapport, and use it to your strength.
Yeah.
Which I think people try to be somebody not, and it's like, man, there's so much opportunity if you just use the experience and the life experience that you've already gone through to benefit you. So
mm-hmm. yeah, that's huge. That's awesome.
That's a great point. I see a lot of people trying to be somebody else and trying to, put on a little bit of a show. Mm-hmm. I think it comes off as fake, right? Mm-hmm. And I think people can sense that.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially being in the social media world. You're starting to see who's fake and who's not, and who's real and who's authentic and who's, you know, just kind of putting on a little bit of a show. People are starting to sniff a lot of that out. Mm-hmm. And, they don't do business with people that aren't real, right? They don't do business with people that they don't trust. And, I think, you know, when I really was like, hey, here's who I am, here's what I'm good at, here's what I'm not good at, and I just shoot straight with people, people want to do more business with me because they're like, dude, I totally get it. Thanks so much for being honest and shooting straight and being genuine in what you do. And, I think it's created more opportunities than by far than has served as a disadvantage, you know, or people saying, I don't want to do business with this kid because he's a blue collar kid from Cleveland. Right.
Correct.
I think it's created way more opportunity than not.
And the people that don't want to do business with you probably didn't want them in the first place.
I don't want
place.
To business with them. Right. Yeah. Right. So we don't align on core values anyways.
Yeah. Right.
So tell me, like, walk me through a multifamily deal. Maybe start
average
small.
Deal or
maybe,
something.
Yeah. Or even a bigger one like you're doing today, but walk me through what that would look like from maybe making the offer, you know, maybe raising the money,
putting it all together.
Yeah, kind of just a quick analysis just so they can understand.
All right, here we go. All right, so first of all, where do you find deals, right? That's where everybody is kind of, how do you go out and find apartment buildings? I come from residential. So I use the same strategies I used in residential. I just use it for commercial. Mm-hmm. So direct mail, mm-hmm. outbound calls, you know, dialing for dollars. Instead of calling for sale by owners, I call for rent by owners. Mm-hmm. Not interested in renting your apartment. I'm interested in buying the whole place.
Right.
Do you have any interest in selling? Driving for dollars, looking for signs of distress. Just like there's houses with tall grass and boarded up windows, there's apartment buildings with tall grass and boarded up windows. Text message, you know, campaigns to landlords. You know, you can extract contact information and skip trace and do all that kind of stuff on residential. You could do it for commercial as well. Drop text message blast, voicemail drops, you know, outbound calls, any of that kind of stuff. So we've done all of that. And as you get bigger and bigger, you can start building these broker relationships. But early on, brokers are just going to send you bottom of the barrel type of opportunities. And they're really not good deals. It's the ones that all the local big investors all said no to. And they're trying to see if you're green enough to buy something that's not a good deal. So eventually, broker relationships is how we've gotten some deals as well. Mm-hmm. But early on, it was not like that. It was just kind of rolling up our sleeves and being in the trenches and doing the work that other people weren't willing to do. And we were able to find deals that other people couldn't find. So as far as finding the deal, all right, that's how we'd find it. Mm-hmm. Let's say a seller, we get a hold of a seller wants to sell the property. I see a lot of people underwriting current financials. The thing with current financials is, if the property's performing great, guess what? You're going to pay a retail price mm-hmm. for that because nobody's going to be motivated to sell it. If the property is does not performing great, most people are like, I'm not interested in that deal. It's not even making any money. I am interested because I look for value add opportunities, right? Just mm-hmm. like you guys look for distressed mm-hmm. properties and you like to create appreciation by either building new or renovating something that's already existing. Mm-hmm. I look for poorly run properties with bad management and they're physically distressed as well. And that means that there's going to be opportunity there. I don't necessarily underwrite deals with their current financials. I underwrite what the stabilized, what the after repair value financials are going to be. And so that's how I look at it. I look at what the after repair rents are going to be. I can talk to my commercial mortgage broker. You guys know our buddy Chris Litzler, mm-hmm. who's in a mastermind with us.
Right.
And could reach out to him and say, hey, what's the average, you know, expense ratio? And that means, you know, hey, between taxes, insurance, utilities, maintenance, management, vacancy, and everything else, the average expenses are going to be 45% in this marketplace. Mm-hmm. So if you got gross income of $100,000 and a 45% expense ratio, that means your net operating income is going to be around $65,000. Then you just figure out what kind of cap rate or what kind of return on investment you're looking for. And so different markets will appraise at different values. But essentially I want to be all in. I figure out whatever the market rate value is going to be, and then I back into it. So apartments are, you know, single family houses, let's say, are valued based on the comparable approach. What did the house down the street sell for that has similar bedroom, similar bathroom, similar square footage, similar size yard? Okay, that's going to tell me what my house is worth. Apartments don't necessarily work that way. They work that way from understanding what did this property down the street sell for as a multiple of their net operating income. Same thing with over here. But just because this property sold for $100,000 a unit doesn't mean my property is going to sell for $100,000 a unit. I might get a similar multiple when they value it, but you know, they might have a higher net operating income than this property has. So it's all based on the income approach. It's what is the income minus the expenses equals the net operating income. And then depending on the city that you're in, you could talk to a mortgage broker or a banker or a real estate commercial mortgage or commercial real estate broker. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell you, hey, properties in Houston appraise at a 5.5% cap rate. That means if somebody bought this thing with cash, that net operating income would yield them a 5.5% return on investment mm-hmm. or a 5.5% cap. So all I say all that to give you what here, that's what's going to tell you what the property's stabilized or after repair value is going to be. Mm-hmm. So now it's like you guys find a house and you say, hey, this house is going to be worth $300,000. you want to be all in for 70 cents on the dollar. So that means you got to be all in for 210 minus the renovation cost is 60 grand. So that means you got to buy it for about 150,000. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So on apartment buildings, there's a couple extra steps to figure out what that stabilized after repair value is. And it might be $3 million. And I want to be all in at 70 cents on the dollar also. So I have to be all in for 2.1 million. And then I subtract out the renovation, which could be $600,000. Mm-hmm. So now I have to be able to buy that apartment building for 1.5 million, put 600 grand into it. I'm all in for 2.1. That puts me at my all in price and make sure I'm at a low enough basis in the property. And then my exit strategy is not to sell. My exit strategy is then to refinance. So I might be able to go and get a 75% LTV loan and then pay off my short-term acquisition or construction loan, pay back all my investors. And then I just have long-term fixed interest rate debt in place. And really all my chips are off the table.
That's
so
awesome.
I know it's kind of like a lot. I fire host you guys, but I tried to go through
that. Thanks for really breaking that down so we can all understand it. So yeah.
And I like the numbers a lot better. I like, I like being all in at 2.1 on a 3 million than, 210 on a 300,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think
it's more, here's the thing, guys. I know a lot of we're in Collective Genius together, mm-hmm. right? Like we know some of the biggest and mm-hmm. best operators in single family in the entire country through that. And I can tell you the folks in CG that are doing 300 deals a year are working way harder than me.
Yeah. Well, I know that.
I have 4,000 doors, but I only own 60 buildings.
Yeah.
Right. And I've done that over the past 5 years. And I didn't own, I had a one building in year one and two more buildings in year two. And then I picked up whatever, 5 or 6 buildings in year three. And then I bought like 20 buildings. More than that, I guess. But over the past 5.5 years or so, I bought 60 buildings. Mm-hmm. So if you average it all out, I'm doing 12 deals a year, not 300 deals a year. I'm just doing bigger deals, right? And so because they're bigger deals, they just have more spread in them. And I don't have to do as many deals.
Yeah.
So what's the future look like for you? What are you doing? What do you look, your 3-5 year out, outlook?
My thing has been, I had to build the balance sheet. I think the really important part is building your balance sheet and being able to qualify for these bigger opportunities and these bigger projects. So I was taking down any building I could for the first several years. I'd buy in C-class areas, I'd buy smaller deals. And until I got up to a few thousand units, I was doing that. Now I'm at a place where I'm kind of taking a step back and cleaning out my portfolio a little bit. I'm any of the C-class that's a little bit more management intensive, I'm selling those. Any of the smaller buildings that don't have the scale that I'm looking for, I'm selling some of those. Some of the markets that are a little bit more tenant friendly and not as landlord friendly, I'm selling those. Mm-hmm. And then I'm just sticking to kind of the core properties. So I'm trying to stick to like B+ areas, 100 units or bigger, landlord friendly states, in primary and secondary markets. Mm. I used to buy a bunch of stuff in like tertiary and like almost like rural markets as well, just because I needed to, again, build the balance sheet.
Right.
So I'm taking a step back and I'm going to sell probably 1,500, maybe even 2,000 units this year. But I'm going to, the goal is to buy another 4,000 doors this year, buy another 4,000 next year. And because they're a little bit nicer and a little bit, just B+, A-, a little bit higher in rent. So the value is going to be a little bit more. I should be able to hit $1 billion in property in assets, essentially. Hopefully by the end of next year is kind of my goal. So that's the push,
cool.
The short-term push. I'm at 330 million, but again, I'm selling, I'm probably 335 right now, but I'm selling a little bit. But I think it's going to really set us up to do some big stuff and clear out a little bit of this, the smaller things. So, my 2 to 3 year goal is $1 billion in assets under management. Now I'm still gonna have debt on that, right? But if we could be all in for 70, 75 cents on the dollar, that means we got about $250 to $300 million of equity that we built up between me, my partners, all the equity investors. And that sets you up, right? Now you're in a really, really good spot.
Yeah.
And I don't know what's after that. I mean, it's interesting, like as you create momentum, I used to have 10-year goals and 20-year goals. it just, things change so much. And like, you have kids and life changes, and you realize, hey, I don't really like doing that anymore. And I don't want to do that. And guess what? Just because society tells me that I should do that doesn't mean I need to, you know? And so I'm kind of going through a little bit of that right now and kind of reflecting on my life and seeing, what do I want to do? Like, I definitely want to focus on getting to $1 billion, but I don't know. Do I want to hit the 2 billion or 10 billion? I don't know. I really like the kids' books. I really like the impact stuff now. That's cool. I might shift focus a little bit more to that.
That's awesome. And tell us a little bit about the mastermind. I know you said you do some coaching and consulting. You know, how can our listeners maybe get involved with you?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I make 90% of my income from doing deals, right? So I do the coaching because I love it, first of all. And secondly, it brings deal flow. And there's a lot of people who come out who are great operators on the single family side. They just need some support, either with raising money or signing on loans or just mentorship, and allows them to kind of get into deals, and I partner up with them. Then there's other people who come out and they're like, man, I love what you're doing. I just don't want to do that much work. And so let me just, I have money or I have access to money. Let me just passively invest with you. And so that's kind of why we built it. There's a lot of deal flow that goes around in our kind of network, and that I'm not involved in as well. And a lot of amazing partnerships. So yeah, it's called Commercial Empire is my coaching platform. It's a 2-day event, and we host it, you know, 4 or 5 times a year, and just kind of teach people how to scale into apartment buildings. So you can go to my website, legacywealthholdings.com, in order to connect with me on that, or just shoot me a message on social media, and I can offer some details on that. But, you know, 2 days, intense, but simplified, right? It's not the complex stuff. Like, my goal is not to teach you 100% of everything that you need to know. My goal is to teach you the things that you need in order to go do a deal, right? Like, how to source deals and how to source money is the two things we really, really focus on. And then when you're ready to focus on operations, we can talk about, you know, other stuff as well, and what that looks like. But yeah, I mean, really, I have Commercial Empire, and then I have my own mastermind, and those are the only two things that I do from an education standpoint. But it's I love it. I love the mastermind. Yeah. I get the most fulfillment from that out of anything that I do.
Well, I love that you love to empower others, and not only that, but you empower children as well, which, tell us about these books. These are actually, we bought these and my kids love them. My daughter's read this book, Think Big, like 3 times. Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story with it. We were actually in Florida this past weekend for our leadership retreat. And she calls and she says, Mommy, I'm on my way to school. I'm like, awesome. She's like, yeah, I'm talking to Grandma and Grandpa about dreaming big, and I'm talking investment strategies.
I love it.
So she's already has that in mind, and she's only 6 years old. So thank you for that. But yeah, I want you to share some of that, because I think it's awesome what you're doing with these children's books.
Yeah, where can they find them? And
it's one of those. So I was coming back from a real estate event, 2017. I'm sorry. Yeah, 2017. My daughter was 2. I was 31 at the time, and I'm reading The Magic of Thinking Big, you know, by David Schwartz.
Love it.
And I'm just reading just the opening chapter, and I'm like, man, these principles are so good, and they're so powerful. And I started thinking back, like, I'm getting this at 31 years old. Can you imagine if I got it at 20 years old? Yeah. Or what if I got it at 11 years old? And I think to my daughter, who was 2 at the time, like, what if I got it when it was 2? And I think a lot of people, so many of us, go through life, you know, being taught a certain way and being programmed a certain way. And then when we get out of school, we have to reprogram ourselves to think like an entrepreneur and think outside the box and think big and not conform to what the masses say. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was thinking, like, what if we didn't have to reprogram and we just were programmed properly from the beginning, right? Like, what if you just were born and raised with these skills? And I started thinking about these families that have legacies and have been around forever, and just they get wealthier and wealthier, not because they pass down estate and treasure and money and property, because they pass down the mindset on how to do all this different kind of stuff. And I started thinking about that. I was like, I need to instill these principles into my daughter from an early age. And so I got off the plane. I started Google searching personal development books for kids. And there was a lot of stuff on how to be nice, you know, live by the golden rule, treat others how you want to be treated, how to work hard, and even some money management type things. But there wasn't anything like on personal development and mindset. There wasn't anything on, you know, whatever you can conceive and believe you can achieve. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't anything on sacrificing things you care about for something you care even more about. That's like a burning white hot desire that you have that you really want to achieve. Goal setting, you know, and how to set goals and all those different kinds of things, how to win friends and influence people, right? Like how to Richest Man in Babylon and all these different like iconic books. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything teaching those principles. And so I thought, what if we took all those classic personal development books and we created children's versions of those? And so I sat on the idea for a couple of years, ended up a year and a half later, partnered up with my wife and one of my best girlfriends from high school. Wasn't a girlfriend, but female friend. they wrote the books because I was so busy building my real estate business. And they've come out awesome. And so like, we're super proud of them. Books are not money makers, but they're impact pieces. So we love that about it. And we've taken Think and Grow Rich and we've turned it into Think Big and Go to Baseball Camp. Uh-huh. We've taken How to Win Friends and Influence People and turned it into How to Win Class President and Influence Peers. Our next book that's coming out is based on Richest Man in Babylon. It's called The Richest Kid in the Neighborhood. Nice. And it's actually my favorite one so far. It's really good. That's awesome. And then we have another one that's going to be coming out over the next couple of months as well. So we'll be at about 4 or 5 books, hopefully by summertime. And I don't know what the next step is with it, but it's we're getting some really amazing stuff. You know, like Joni, what you're saying is awesome. I love hearing those stories. I've gotten messages from other people in CG and other entrepreneur friends of mine who, you know, have started businesses with their kids based on the books. And they started setting goals and writing them all out on a whiteboard with their kids. And it's pretty cool to be able to, you know, play a small part in that.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, I can't wait for the other two books to come out. I read these to my daughter, so I'm getting all into it as well. I'm like, ooh, that's cool.
That's awesome. I mean, it's not out there. We've looked for our kids. Yeah. And Angie Priscilla, I think, did some like Otis and
Otis and Charlie. Those are good books.
That's another one. But yeah, that's awesome. So, I mean, just keep doing what you're doing, man.
I appreciate it, man. No, it means a lot. And it's again, it's an impact piece. I think early on, a lot of people, you know, like I told you, my goal was to make a bunch of money early on in my career. And you know, I'm not only into like, you know, personal finance, but I also am into, you know, personal development and happiness and fulfillment. And I've done a lot of studying on all those things. And I remember watching a documentary back in probably 2014-ish that said, hey, once your basic needs are met in life, and you got food on the table and clothes on your back and a roof over your head, and you live in a safe neighborhood, it doesn't matter if you make $50,000 or $50 million a year. There's no difference in your happiness factor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that to me was like very revealing and very eye-opening. And although I like making money because I think you can make a bigger impact the more money that you have, I'm not chasing the money. I'm chasing the things I can do with the money, and I'm chasing the difference that I can make with the money. And really, you know, the fulfillment I think starts coming from the impact and the differences and being able to retire your spouse or your parents or, you know, building a school or building a church or building a hospital or, you know, sending a terminally ill kid to Disney on Ice or something along those lines that just, you can't do those things unless you're, you know, performing and achieving at a high level. And I think that's why we should all achieve at a high level. And I think there's a lot of us, I mean, people who are listening to your podcast obviously have something burning inside of them that they know that they are made for more and can do big things. And I think when you have the ability to be great and do great things, I think you have the responsibility to be great and do great things. And so that's kind of like what drives me today. And that's what really drives us with the books too.
Sweet. Well, man, it was awesome. I hope everybody needs to re-listen to this because I think you provided a ton of value.
Yes.
So again, we appreciate you being here. It was a big honor. We respect you a lot. So hopefully we get to hang out with you and the family soon. So we'd love.
Yeah, we got to go on vacation with our families together.
Absolutely, we should definitely need to plan that.
Yeah, for sure. So you guys come to Charleston anytime you want. I got a house right there on the beach.
I know, I see all the pictures. I'm like, man, Tim is loving life.
He can go right on his back porch. And
get over here. Come visit this summer. I'd love to have you guys.
That'd be fun.
I appreciate you guys. Again, I respect our business friendship, our business relationship, and even more so our friendship. And have a ton of respect for what you guys have built and everything that you're doing and the impact that you're making. So thank you so much for all the moves that you're making and all the impact that you're creating across the entire industry. So thank you.
Yeah, and we'll share your the link to your website, to the mastermind and all that in the show notes, and then also your social media site so people can follow you.
Yeah, social media is perfect. Yeah, I appreciate that.
So thank you guys. Well, thank you, and stay tuned till next week, and have a great week.
Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to Inside the Wolf's Den, an entrepreneurial journey with Sean and Joni Wolfswinkel. Tons of entrepreneurial podcasts are out there talking.
Talking.
But Joni and Sean are living it every single day. Their portfolio now includes many franchises and medium-sized businesses. We talk about the trials and motivators of successfully running a business. Join us again soon for another podcast. But until then, reach out on the website at InsideTheWolf'sDen.com, on Facebook at Inside the Wolf's Den, on Instagram at Inside the Wolf Den. We'll see you again soon. This is Inside the Wolf's Den. We'll see you next time.